you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Richard Houck on the show. He's the author of Liberalism Unmasked. He joins our show tonight to, of course, discuss that book and perhaps a few other issues. Richard, how are you doing?
Doing pretty well. How are you?
Not too well. I mean, not too well. Not too bad. I'm sorry. Not too well. I'll be honest with you. No, I'm fine now.
Perfectly honest.
Yeah, perfectly. Usually people ask that question. They really don't want to know. Right. No, but that's fine. The book, Liberalism Unmasked, of course, you also contributed a few websites. Any more information you want to share with us?
Yeah, I have some articles. Some of the articles, about 2.5 years ago, I started publishing things kind of publicly. Some of the earlier articles appear on the Occidental Observer. It's Kevin McDonald is the head editor of that. And then all the recent stuff I've really been publishing on Countercurrents. Mm-hmm. That's counter-currents.com. And Greg Johnson's the editor over there. And, do some shows, you know, every once in a while. And I'm on Twitter at HeyWildRich. And, if you go to my Twitter, I have links to like a big thread of links of the last couple years worth of articles all up there if you're looking for any of them.
Okay, great. Now, this book, Liberalism Unmasked, is published by Arctos, correct?
Correct.
And that's John Bruce Leonard's
operation. Yeah, John was actually he was my editor for the book.
Okay, yeah. I've actually had a few talks with him. In fact, he's scheduled to come on pretty soon.
Oh, so nice.
Talk about his book.
It just came out not too long.
So this book, Liberalism Unmasked, you diagnosed liberalism as a mental illness?
It's, I guess the kind of the better way to put it is it's like less of the layman's term of mental illness that you kind of think of colloquially. Mm-hmm. I guess I have to break down mental illness a little bit to explain what I mean. It's anytime you have a pattern of behavior that's maybe maladaptive or disruptive or leads to a suboptimal result, kind of historically it's been called a mental illness. It's some sort of aberration of what would otherwise achieve a better result. So that's kind of the frame I'm looking at it from, very much like the classical clinical sense of we have this behavior going on and let's just look at it, talk about it, break it down, and explain that it ends up, you know, when you follow these liberal policies through, just mass migration as an easy example, or the kind of radical new wave feminism is another example, you end up with one of the studies I cite in there, a few studies about feminism, is that this push towards the workplace, push towards promiscuity, push towards abortion. All these studies show that women, as compared to men, relatively and absolutely, are the least happiest that they've ever been. It shows there's all kinds of studies that show a correlation effect. Obviously, you can't do a true experiment on promiscuity and abortion and thing like that, but that these women who have more and more sexual partners tend to have less life satisfaction, higher rates of divorce. Same kind of thing with abortions. You see less life satisfaction. Stay-at-home moms and stay-at-home working moms are the most happy out of women that are surveyed. Women in jobs like PR and marketing and things tend to be the least happy. But all of the modern kind of feminism canon is pushing women towards these sort of careers. So when I say it's a mental illness, what I'm saying is that this pattern of behavior leads to very bad outcomes, as maybe somebody who's a sociopath or a histrionic or any other number of disorders. You know, you're not saying that this person is maybe, I guess in some ways you're saying it's a broken person, but you're not just, it's not a throwaway like, oh, they're just mentally ill, don't worry about them. You're saying, okay, there's this pattern of behavior, there's this pattern of thought, and it's leading to bad results. So, you know, applying this kind of the way I'm looking at liberalism to mass migration, you see welfare rates going up, you see crime rates going up, social capital destroyed, wages being driven down, drugs coming across the border, all kinds of, whether it's petty crime, violent crime, all sorts of these very disruptive things happening in society as a result for this desire for mass migration, which is kind of underneath that, this desire to cater to an out-group and to shun your in-group, which is also very maladaptive from the evolutionary psychology perspective. People who were not weary of outsiders usually ended up being killed by outsiders or taken as slaves or something like that historically. So that's kind of the, you know, when I say I'm diagnosing it and looking at it, that's really what we're getting into, these patterns of behaviors and thinkings that lead to all these negative outcomes, more so than just saying, that person's got a mental illness. And then that's that, which is, and I understand that some people think that, because there was some, you see a lot of the people on Twitter, like the normie cons, anytime a liberal says anything, they're just like, oh, they're just mentally ill. And it's like a throwaway line. They don't really, I don't know if they really mean it or not, but I don't think they're taking it to the kind of in-depth level that I'm looking at it in the book.
Yeah, it's almost like there are objective conditions that have been created, which naturally result in what is described as mental illness, dissatisfaction.
Sure.
Anxiety, which leads to alcohol, high rates of alcohol consumption, drug addiction, legal and illegal. Prescription drug use goes up, and these things, and a lot of this stuff, and of course the psychological community, the psychiatric and psychological community, will diagnose these as mental illnesses, like attention deficit disorder,
yes,
increased anxiety, and these things. Well, what they do is they seek solutions in pharmacology and gets more power for the psychological and psychiatric community, but they're not willing to address the conditions in the society that have been created by liberal policies, which create crazy people, in, so to speak, right? So
you do get a lot of that. One of the things that you kind of just hit on that I talk about is that in a lot of like the real historic older stuff, one of the foundations of saying somebody was having mental illness was that they were very disconnected from reality. I use an example kind of, not really jokingly, of a person that I heard about in a clinical psych class. There was this guy who collected like egg cartons and batteries, and he thought he was building a rocket ship. He was a schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. And he was, you call him mentally ill because he was so disconnected from reality. And a lot of the beliefs in liberalism, it's very disconnected from reality. These things on absolute denial of difference, like biological difference between races, and even more absurdly, probably, well, arguably, gender.
Yeah, yeah.
So you see these things, and any child knows there's a difference between men and women. They've done studies on monkeys with the toys. Girl monkeys like dolls and boy monkeys like trucks and balls, you know, and they haven't been socialized in this patriarchal, misogynistic society that the liberals say. And so you see these constant denials of reality, and then that leads to these different cognitive dissonances. And I talk about that too, where you're just, you know, you're so out of touch from reality. There's another example. I'm not sure if I used in the book or not, but it's, you know, the guy that thinks the CIA is after him, or he's being tracked, right? Like, you know, that guy, if it's not true, he has something wrong with him. If it is true, if he's actually being tracked by the CIA and everyone else just doesn't see it and he's right, you know, eventually if the truth comes out, he will be vindicated as correct because he was actually dealing in reality and everyone else was refusing to see it. So it's, you have this level of, like, you need an objective truth so that you know if the CIA, if the guy's actually suffering from paranoid delusions or if he's just so keenly aware and everyone else isn't. Mm-hmm. So I kind of talk about that sort of thing where, you know, there's the, I guess the philosophy and epistemology of it, who's actually mentally ill here. And you can see how in that situation it can change. But I think looking at a lot of the data and just kind of historical things that you see that liberals are operating on these positions that are just very outside of reality and just observable things about, you know, men and women being completely equal. It's just, you know, patent absurdity, but they will insist it, you know, no matter what the outcome means.
And again, a lot of the alienation, atomization, dissatisfaction, loneliness that people suffer in our society today is a product of sort of this ideological commitment to things like diversity, multiculturalism, because those things inevitably have to destroy hierarchical, patriarchal, illiberal institutions, which actually create the social institutions that society really needs to sort of smooth out people's, you know, as they get older and develop, become adults. But successive generations have been gradually denied these things in the name of radical equality.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's a kind of a thread I talk about in a recent article on Countercurrents called How Diversity Harms Friendships. And I was, you know, kind of, there's a book and research by Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone, and then he did his big research at E Pluribus Unum at Harvard. And one of the big, you know, takeaways from that research is that as diversity goes up, social capital goes down and people have less friends. Well, there's all these studies coming out recently that shows millennials have, you know, there was something like 20 to 30% of millennials say they have zero friends. And a huge number say they have zero close friends and just acquaintances. And there was another article that said some number, I forget what percent it was, but feel that they have no purpose in life and nothing to live for. And so you see, like you said, this atomization, this lack of friends, this lack of community is going up just as the research, the diversity research that Putnam and many others, I mean, there's the idea of racial diversity and social capital and friends has been replicated many times. And one of the studies I cite was a study on friendship, and it showed that most people, the overwhelming number of white people, including liberals, have only white friends. And same thing, most, you know, people of any other race, most of their close friends are within their own race. And it's by many, many times. So as you can see, as society becomes more and more diverse, you have less opportunity to make close friends because you gravitate towards people that are more like you and more similar racially and ethnically and all of that. So yeah, as you increase the diversity with mass migration and forced integration and these platitudes of diversity is our strength, you're robbing people of the community and friendship and really any sense of purpose because of all that.
And this isn't just by accident. I think there's a wider or larger agenda afoot here because that's how you create a perfect slave class.
Yeah, it definitely is. And this, I mean, there's been writings for over 100 years that talk about different ways to kind of create a class of people that's easier to manipulate, whether it was, You know, you have, you know, early stuff like Kalergi writing about it and Hooten plans and Coffin plans and just over and over and over again throughout history, particularly the last 100 years or so, you see these people who were maybe part of some elite class in society, some ruling class or aspiring ruling class would kind of promote this atomization and promote this melting pot and diversity and nation of immigrants and all these sort of things. And yeah, you see it as a constant theme, and it's these people that push it. You know, they've seen the studies too. There was even an article in New York Times after one of Putnam's either books or studies came out, where it says clear as day that, you know, the writer who's talking about Putnam's research says that the more diversity you have, the less people vote and less people spend time outside. So yeah, it even hurts their health. In one of the studies I was seeing, because they spend so much more time inside just watching TV. They don't go outside because they don't have neighbors to go talk to. They don't feel safe outside walking. They don't feel, you know, they don't have any sense of community, so they just stay inside. But yeah, all these people pushing it, they don't do it because they like us. They've seen the same studies that I have and other people have, and they're still pushing this all the same.
A good example, like his case study in this is, it's a good, actually, it's a good study or a good example. It would be Sweden, because it's a relatively small population, 9 to 10 million people. And in the past, really the past century, they've been gradually socializing their society. But it really picked up in the 30s and the 40s, slowed down in the 50s, and since the 60s, when radical feminism was being enforced in Sweden, particularly, in the 70s. But I think they have very high rates of depression. I think 80% of teenage girls have eating disorders in Sweden. And, wow. If you look what's happened in Swedish society, the destruction of the traditional family, the extended family, then the nuclear family, with the sort of forced feminism, with paternal and maternal leave. And I think in the going into the 1960s, the average Swedish mother would spend 14 hours in the house. And by the 1975, that had been reduced to 4, and they'd been thrown into the workforce. So this means the children were then being raised in daycare centers. And now by the 80s, I think about half being born out of wedlock, declining birth rates, and then they're set up for this mass migration issue where they bring in, because the birth rates are low, they're told they have to accept migrants from, you know, from Africa of all places. And this has created, the high trust society has turned into a low trust society. And you have this explosion in crime in Sweden.
I've seen the crime going up. The rate of rapes has gone crazy. And there was, I talk about in the book, I think it was Denmark. It was one of the Nordic countries, but they took in about a tenth of the migrants that Sweden has, and they have about a tenth of the rapes. And if you look at the breakdown of offenders by race and country of origin, you see it's not the native Swedes or the native Danes or whatever doing it. Some of the places they've ordered a stop to collecting the racial data because of how damning it is. And yeah, I cite quite a few studies in the feminism chapter, I believe, maybe in the mass migration chapter, about the number of women through Europe that have said that they're afraid to even leave the house or won't leave the house after dark. And that's just the function of, you know, being atomized and having all these like basically violent invaders in your country roaming around committing all sorts of sex crimes constantly and all sorts of other violent crimes. It's crazy. And there's just in the U.S., there's almost a million a year, almost a million violent crimes against white people a year from blacks and Hispanics. And the number's way, way disproportionate. It's like white people are attacked like 27 times to one by blacks, and whites attack blacks. So you have close to a million people victimized a year. Just basically through forced proximity. And people saw recently, you know, you can't go a week without seeing something about Jim Crow or the KKK or something. And, you know, when you think in comparison, it's almost absurd. You think, okay, well, we're, you know, a million white people are getting raped, mugged, pistol whipped, you know, punched in the face at the knockout game, all these horrible things, carjacked, you know, home invasions. And the what we're hearing about is that blacks had to use a different water fountain and go to a different school and swim in a different pool. They had a water fountain, they just had to use a different one. And when you think about, you know, how much, what was really, where was the harm being done then compared to now? They talk about segregation being the worst thing ever, but integration has been far worse by millions of times, really, but when you talk about the victims.
Yeah, and the integration itself was used to break up ethnic neighborhoods where there was this community, and it was intended to create white flight, so you had suburbia, and create further alienization and kind of create the white middle class, the deracinated white middle class. But you look at the crime statistics, crime is largely a demographic issue. It's and this, at the very least, if you don't address the demographic realities, you don't address, you know, you're not addressing the real problem, or nor can you propose policies to deal with it. Because you are trapped by this ideology of equality, multiculturalism, and the cult of integration. And again, I think it's all designed, because without that, with the pretext of integration and multiculturalism, you destroy community, which is the ultimate objective, I think, in these things.
Yeah, I think the destruction of the community, and also I think the victimization. I think the people knew it was going to happen, and I think that's why. I think that's why Southern integration and then even before that Reconstruction was so, the Southern opposition to first Reconstruction and then to integration was so fierce, was because they knew what was going to happen, because they had experience with this more than Northerners or anybody else really would have some from some. You know, it's easy to be in a homogenous European country and think, oh, the Southerners were so terrible, when they weren't used to dealing with these kind of people.
Yeah. You that effect where I think it was Joe Sobran who commented that white liberals have the migration and mating habits of the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, I kind of talk about that too in the book. Sobran was great. One of the things I talk about is the extreme cognitive dissonance liberals have with this, them constantly seeking white spaces and going living in white neighborhoods and sending their kids to white schools, and while believing they have this white privilege, and they're always trying to balance this idea of, like, I want to be in a good white liberal and show I'm not racist, but also they're terrified to be in any sort of integrated or black neighborhood. They never would send their kids to those schools, or very, very rarely.
The only brown people see in those neighborhoods are the ones doing the landscaping.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And they have this, you know, they have this dissonance where they think, you know, okay, I'm a good person, I'm a good liberal, I believe in equality, but they don't live it. And that is something that I think that a lot of them struggle with, and kind of leads them to this. They just do so much stuff. I was in undergrad at Ohio State. I was in a criminology class, and the amount of things, like these different theories people offered to explain these different rates of crime among races, was just incredible. One of the big ones is socioeconomic factors, is that they believe that poor people commit more crime. And I addressed that in the book, in the white privilege chapter, and some the poorest white areas, like in Appalachia, for example, have less crime than more affluent, diverse neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And that the correlation coefficient of the presence of blacks and Hispanics to crime is something like 0.7, or it's very high. And the correlation to education and income is like 0.3, very low. So even among higher income, and even among the highest earners of blacks, like the top 10% of earners of blacks commit more murder than even the lowest, the poorest white people. So you see, you know, they will say it's socioeconomics, and then they'll say it's generational socioeconomics, and it's always something else. to not address the fact that just, you know, people are different. It's weird. That's one of the kind of things I talk about in The Dissonance. They will say diversity is great and we're different and that should be celebrated. And then you say, okay, I believe that we're different. We have some different traits. And oh no, not that. Don't do that. You know, not there. That's not what we were talking about. It's just, there's just so many mental gymnastics you have to constantly go through to be a good liberal.
And there is, I was reading certain interesting statistics. Sorry, regarding gun violence or I think gun homicides and per 100,000. And if you just take, I guess what it's described as white America, the ethnic groups that make up of white Americans, it's the lowest in the world. I mean, it's almost non-existent. Then it shoots up with Hispanics. It's like 19 per 100,000. With blacks, it's like 27 per 100,000. So it becomes, even at the gun issue, and talking about gun violence, it is a demographic question. And
yeah,
it's not the gun itself. It's who has the gun and the finger pulling the trigger.
Yep, that's absolutely right. I have that in the firearm chapter. I have a chapter about the Second Amendment, and it covers everything from the gun rates by race to like the original intent of what the purpose of the Second Amendment was, and some of these arguments about the militia clause and these different things. And kind of, you still see people making this argument constantly that the militia clause meant you had to be in a government militia, even though it was decided in 2008 in Heller versus DC, the first time the Supreme Court really got into the militia clause, which is another interesting thing about liberalism, is that if a Supreme Court holding doesn't go how they want it to, they completely ignore it. It was just Scalia. He's just a hack. We don't have to listen to that. But anything else happens is settled law.
Yeah, like Roe v. Wade or something.
Yeah, if it's Roe v. Wade, Loving versus Virginia, all those, basically every 14th Amendment case.
Brown versus Board of Education.
Yeah, Brown versus Board, Palmer versus Sadati, all those. They this was absolutely correct. They got it right. Anybody who says different is an idiot. But then you say, okay, well, in 2008, we just talked about this militia clause. Oh, no, you're an idiot for thinking that. It's just crazy. But yeah, the crime rates by the gun homicide by race I talk about, it's highly concentrated. If you just remove some of the big cities, the rate of the U.S. murder rate drops way down. If you just do white Americans, it's something like a 1.4 per 100,000 or something like that. It's very, very low, among some of the lowest. It's like in the bottom third or bottom quarter in the world of homicide rates, while being the most heavily armed, which is also interesting. So it's not just like we're a country that, like in UK after their, I think it was Dunblane. Yeah, it was Dunblane there.
Yeah.
And then Port Arthur was Australia. But it's not like that, where they had these confiscations and stuff. And they say, okay, well, the gun crime is low because, you know, we took the guns. No, it's, you know, Americans, white Americans, while being the most heavily armed people, have some of the lowest murder rates. And that just, when I was kind of looking at some of the data for that, it was shocking to see. I knew it would be lower than what it is when you count Hispanics and blacks and whatnot. But the fact that we have so many guns and it's still really pretty low, you know, down by like France and Tibet and stuff, it was kind of shocking to me even.
I was reading a article today about the Moynihan Report and the plan by, I guess at the time he was working for he wasn't a senator, he was working for the Johnson administration. He was working for the, I don't think it was the Justice Department. It may have been the House Health, Education, and Welfare at the time. But he came up with an idea about one of the ideas was he wanted policies that would support the black family because he saw the alarming increase in illegitimacy. And at the time, I think it was just over 20%. And he called it a crisis in the black family at the time. And he said all these Great Society programs that are being planned and implemented aren't going to count for anything unless we address the crisis of the family. And this stems from Moynihan's background. He himself came from a broken family, but he was steeped in Catholic tradition, Catholic social teaching, particularly regarding the family. So he was aware of this. And he thought you have to get this in order before we deal with the bigger issues. And it was rejected because his plan about supporting the black family at the time ran against the zeitgeist of sexual liberation. and that this is the 60s, sexual liberation, the budding of feminism. And in order to do that, in order to support family, you have to support sexual, morality, traditional, what would be sexual Christian morality.
Sure.
And liberals weren't willing to address that because at the time, this is, you get into the sort of the ulterior motives of why the civil rights movement was promoted by certain groups was because blacks themselves, and this was part of this intellectual trend that it, in the 20th century with Norman Mailer and Jack Kerouac, the idea of the liberated Negro, the Negro sexual revolutionary, is being celebrated.
Yeah.
And this was the image of the black they were promoting because they wanted to promote this behavior. But the point was, if you don't get a hold of this chaos in the community, it's not going to make a difference because community multiple. You have to have, in order to have a middle class black, middle class blacks, you have to have middle class values. And they weren't willing to embrace bourgeois traditional values because they were, again, guided by their ideology. They wanted liberation. Not only, and you write about this, the Luther King article you wrote, is the fact that the civil rights movement, the establishment, was highly sexually compromised at the time itself.
Oh, yeah.
They were degenerates. And this isn't talked about much, But this was a point. He said you have to deal with the values and the behavior. It's behavior. And particularly, it wasn't a broad, it wasn't like big government policy going to solve this. Individuals, people had to act morally and responsibly, but that went against the zeitgeist at the time. And as a result, we got what we had in the 60s and 70s and the meltdown that we experienced. By the way, it's interesting that he would say that 21-22% was a crisis. Now it's 80%, and it's like 25% overall, and I think in the white community.
Yeah, it's the white community has, I mean, all of those policies, the sexual liberation, the feminism, the just knowing that, there was a time where if you weren't married and you had a kid, you're going to have a very hard life. And now if you're not married and you have kids, you can still have an iPhone and Netflix and, still go out to the club. It's not, I'm obviously not a single mother with kids, but like, I imagine this is the easiest time it's ever been.
Yeah.
To be a single mother with kids. And you had that, that is interesting that, the policies, like I said, the feminism and welfare and the promotion of all this promiscuity and degeneracy have hit everybody, but you kind of see it's skewed in a way. Like it's gone way up for the white family and for the black family, but more so for the black family than it was before.
Well, now it's utterly. I mean, you can't, with 80% with that much chaos, you're simply not going to resolve any problems with that much chaos. They have to get things in, and it's beyond anything that government can do for them at this point because it's just you can't have that much chaos in your life and have any constructive engagement in the society in general.
It really is, and it was the only time. Even kind of before all that, their kind of like out of wedlock children was still higher. It was always a little higher than the white community, but it seemed that the only time it could be even remotely manageable was going back to those evil segregationist times when there wasn't the welfare and wasn't full integration and everything. It was the only time they kind of acted a little better when they had to. And it sounds harsh to say, but it's
well, it goes against the it goes against the narrative and also just the civic. I guess it's heresy. I guess you could say it goes against the canon of acceptable thought now. Because we've given a historical narrative, which the progression of liberty, eyes on the prize, marching for justice, Martin Luther King speaking in these things, so to question that is to become a heretic.
Yeah, that reminds me of this. There was an article on Countercurrents that Greg Johnson wrote, because or it might have been a talk. Maybe it was one of their radio shows on there, but. It said, you are miserable because you are free. And there's another one I saw that had, a famous 20th century statement on it. And it said, like, men are tired of liberty or something like that. And it was this idea of returning back to the idea of, like, self-mastery and the concept of Obrecht. And, like, you're not just free to be a wanton degenerate. You're focusing on self-mastery and discipline, and that is where you get your freedom and you have you know, when you don't have any sort of discipline or anything imposed on you or any sort of sense of duty, you just end up like, you know, spending hours all day looking at degenerate porn and Netflix and playing video game, and you're miserable because you're so free, is kind of the idea of it.
Yeah, it's you need to have, you need to control your passions, and you need you need the reason has to ride the horse of passion, has to, you know, and that's the symbol, that's the idea we've been given, that type of, that notion has been lost in the age of total liberty. And that, you know, they enslave you by telling you you're free, and that's it. Feminism is a great example of that.
Feminism is the push for pornography, the push to legalize recreational drugs, mm-hmm. all of that stuff. It's like, you know, the push, people being able to drink more. It's all, you know, these things, drugs, pornography, have historically been used by an oppressor class to control a people they were trying to control, whether it was broadcasting pornography and over the airwaves or pushing opium onto a people so they could manipulate them. And now it's like, people think, oh, I'm so free to smoke weed in the street. It's great. And they don't like this libertarian strain of freedom. They don't seem to realize they're being enslaved by their own freedom.
Well, yeah, because if you get someone addicted to their, man has many masters as he has vices, as St. Augustine said. And those who are in the position to provide those vices are going to be able to control you. And that's sexual liberation is political control, as Ian Michael Jones says. And that's what we have. And that goes back to the early days of the French Revolution with the Palais Royal and the, you know, I guess the idea, I think it was Marquis de Sade that said, the way you fight counter-revolution is you have women dance naked in the theater. The only problem back then is the theater can only be so big, and you have to be close up to see the naked women. Film, and of course the internet has changed that. For, you know, the advent of film, where you could produce porn films, then television, then the internet. Now it's mass produced, and you know everything in society costs something. But somehow pornography is now essentially free. Gee, isn't that nice of them?
Yeah, exactly. Like they're so benevolent. You know, they're just doing it because they think that they're so kind to you. There are these, you know how it's like no fat, no nut November now.
Oh yeah.
I've been following all. There's been quite a few articles.
Apparently, it's had an impact.
It has had. It's been a thing for a long time. I used to follow a couple forums. I don't know if it's still around, but on the miscellaneous section of bodybuilding.com, it used to be one of the largest forums on the internet. I don't know what its traffic. I know its traffic's died way down, but I used to post on there and read on there a lot. And there was like a no-fap community back then, and there's Your Brain on Porn that gets into a lot of the neuroscience of it and the addiction. Yeah. And it's really interesting stuff. I encourage anybody to check it out. But some of the things I've been kind of following recently are all these articles pushing people to masturbate and pushing porn on people. There was this one that said Daily Show correspondent explores how not masturbating fuels alt-right anger.
it produces fascism.
Yeah. And there's this woman that said it was no surprise to find that the so-called no-fat movement had its roots in anti-gay, anti-women, and anti-Semitic blogs. And there was one I saw somewhere that said something similar, that no porn, no fap is inherently anti-Semitic. And that's, you know, it's been well documented that the majority of people producing porn are the same people running the mass media, and same people in Hollywood. Their cousins.
Yeah, it's the Amish, right? But,
yeah. the Chi-Coms, yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, that goes with Wilhelm Reich, who wrote The Mass Psychology of Fascism. This is funny because this isn't, I mean, we laugh at it, but it's a very sophisticated understanding of human nature here.
It's not new either.
He said, I mean, he was like a cultural Marxist in the 20s and 30s, and he'd be trying to get people to embrace atheism and communism and these things, socialism. And he couldn't get anywhere because you don't argue like theology, you know, with I guess he's an ostrich, a Catholic, and he says you don't argue that with a seminary student. I think what he said, you don't argue religion with them. You talk to them about sex, and you get them to masturbate a lot. And once they start doing that, the idea of God evaporates, right? And yeah, so this is, you don't directly say, hey, but you get people engaged in the sexual corruption, then everything falls into place. And they know that, you know, which is, you know, it's, but it is quite funny that they say that not masturbating essentially it's, that's kind of like the authoritarian personality critique where a normal family is, and it leads to the Führer.
It's very much, very Adorno-esque, absolutely Adorno-esque. And how, like, wanting a normal society that functions is something wrong with you. And that's actually, Adorno, among others, was sort of the kind of the nexus for my book, where I was in a different social psychology and sociology classes. And one, we talked about right-wing authoritarianism and social dominance orientation and the authoritarian personality. So I was exposed to all of these things. In a really, you know, in an academic setting, not just like, it's one thing to read like the Wikipedia page and see stuff on it online. It's another time to spend like a whole semester on it, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it really, I kind of joke that was that class and a couple other experiences in undergrad really radicalized me. That class, being exposed to so many twin studies, and then just my interactions of realizing how much more I had in common with like the white janitor that was 20 years older than me that I would chat with, mm-hmm, than the non-white student sitting next to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those kind of things really cemented my views, oddly enough. Cause you know, you think they think, oh, go get a nice liberal education and you won't become a fascist. And it's like the opposite, but, even the counter stuff to, or I'm sorry, the people arguing against masturbation have been around for a long time. There was like this idea in Think and Grow Rich about sexual transmutation, about how the energy gets into other stuff. And there was, a famous Austrian painter kind of wrote about it in his book, talked about something along the lines of sexual activity just deters you from higher pursuits and impairs intellectual thoughts. And the most successful people in history have abstained from masturbation and different things. And there's, you know, other kind of quotes to back this up in different. There's a book by Robert Payne who studies fascism and writes a lot about fascism and proto-fascism. And he talks about how Hitler's friend says that Hitler never masturbated and detested like sexual jokes and spoke about physical purity in a way as though he believed in some higher law, as it could achieve something else, like in this metaphysical idea of not masturbating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been around for a long time.
At the risk of agreeing with Hitler. No.
right. That's exactly. That's kind of why I, framed it in such a way. Just to keep your show, keep it safe.
At the risk of agreeing with Hitler.
So you have these people that were culture, became the cultural Marxists and the Frankfurt School people saying, different, trying to get you to masturbate. And the nexus of the sexual revolution were a lot of these people as well. And then, on the counter to that, you have these people who were kind of also these infamous and heroic figures arguing against just pornography and masturbation and stuff. So this nofap thing is very fascinating to me because of how hard they're pushing against a few guys on the internet trying to not watch porn for a month, and then tying the historic stuff into it, that you realize this is nothing new. We've been doing this for 100 years now with our sworn enemies.
Yeah. And it's kind of, there was an episode in Seinfeld, I think, where George had a girlfriend who simply couldn't have sex.
Okay.
And so it just wasn't on his mind for an extended period of time. And he started to develop intellectually and achieve great things.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So I was like,
surprising that was even like that. It just shows how different the time, like that would never be allowed on TV now.
Yeah, I know. It's just the moment he got worrying about it, he's like, wow, he became smarter, more productive. And of course, this isn't saying that, everyone should abstain from sex. That's not possible. But the thing is, if you put it off for the right moment, then if you ask yourself a question, if we live in a society where the norm was, society-supported institutions, the behavior of both male and female supported this idea that sex was only for holy matrimony. And it was, so in your youth, you could devote that energy to developing a skill, a trade, a job So the point when in your early 20s, you are good marriage material, and so is your opposite, your mate, the female you meet, and all this is kind of understood. I this is traditional society I'm describing here.
Right, right.
It would be a lot less pressure on anybody and on everybody, right? I mean, and then society would be happier. They have these institutions, and you'd have community. You'd have homogenous communities that were kind of self-governing. But that's complete opposite of what the oligarchs want, though. So they destroyed it.
Yeah, the self-governing thing is interesting. I was I recently was out. Left my house a little bit more than I do. I'm kind of a bit of a recluse, to be honest. But I was at this farm, like a big farmer's market where mm-hmm. they had hay rides and pumpkin picking and stuff. And it was almost all white people there. And I was just shocked at the difference if you go somewhere like the mall in the city where I'm close to. And I'm working on an article now about, my travels as a mall rat. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've noticed as it gets more and more diverse is the presence of police and security. And I just went to I rarely go to the movies, and I just went to see a movie, and they were doing like bag searches. And I thought, man, when this city was all white, they didn't do this.
Yeah.
They weren't searching your bags. And just how, when you have a diverse community, it was shocking at how much like security and police and just chaperone presence was needed. And when I was at this farm, it was just acres and acres of white people and kids, and like kids running around, and people, would bump into each other. Oh, sorry about that. And they didn't need any, they were totally self-governing. Any problems that they had, they seemed to work out on their own. Nobody was getting in fights. Nobody was yelling at each other. And there was opportunity for it. The amount of people in a close proximity, I guess, and, people bumping into each other on accident and stuff. And then I see the same thing happen in the mall, people bump into each other, and then, they end up getting in a fight in the food court because someone scuffs somebody's shoes.
Yeah.
And it's just totally different type of societies, and it just it seems one of the day-to-day things we have to deal with. So now we have to deal with having our bags searched and security everywhere. And
well, I think they better put HUD better put like a public housing unit in that near that farm. And
they probably will. It's probably targeted.
Enrich the area, as they say.
Yeah, they probably will. I mean, there was that Obama policy. They were basically targeting zip codes that were too white to have diversity sent there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that's, people say that is a meme and a joke online, but it's real. It's not now, just
by targeting that's too right. Do they just like look at the crime statistics and extrapolate from that, or do they actually?
Yeah, just they can look at. Yeah, I mean, probably, but you just look on, the census. Just look at the zip code, and you could pull it up. I'm sure. But yeah, just we're much more self-governing people, and that's why I think a lot of this. People talk about online this kind of thread about like the original intent of America, for example, about a self-governing people. It had to be a homogenous European society. And when you see it, it was so clear to me because like on a Friday night, I was at the mall and people were just going crazy. And then the next night and the next day evening, I'm at the farmer's market, and it was just night and day, literally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, what was it, the 1790? Immigration Act, which
that was the first Immigration Act ever passed on with the first Continental Congress,
and it was kind of understood up until 1965. Really,
they had some ebbs and flows, but the interesting thing about that 1790 Immigration Act that limited citizenship to free white people, that was actually before the Bill of Rights, which was all ratified in 1791. So mm-hmm. a year before, gun rights, free speech, they said just white people. And then they kept it that way. They even made it when the Federalists did the Sedition Act, the Alien and Sedition Act. The Sedition Act gets a lot of rep because it's because then you have Madison's Virginia Report kind of going against it because of its importance to American free speech theory.
Yes. Yeah.
But before that, the other part of it was they were making it. The Federalists were giving the federal government more power to restrict immigration. They wanted it to be even like tighter. And then you have, this ebb and flow going back and forth where you have some different things going on, whether it was like dealing with, they had Native American questions, Chinese questions, mm-hmm. different things like that. And then you had, after the Bolshevik Revolution, a bunch of these Bolshevik subversives coming over. So they did the Emergency 1924 Act, which Madison Grant had a big play in. And then, you know, that kind of set the stage then for the Jacob Javits and Emanuel Sallard to undo it, because they were very upset that it was keeping their ethnic tribesmen out of the country. And then, you know, as you mentioned, just in 1965, just kind of threw the whole thing open. No racial quotas, no origin quotas, just totally opened the door for anybody showing up.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence that also the same year the Civil Rights Act was passed.
Yeah, that was Civil Rights Act with Seller was involved in. You had the Voting Rights Act. You had 3 years later in 68, the Fair Housing Act, which basically codified the Shelley versus Kramer, which outlawed being able to have racially restrictive covenants. So like if we, you know, for people who don't know, if you and I were neighbors, we could basically enter into a land contract with each other that says, I won't sell to anybody but whites and you don't sell to anybody but whites. So that if one of us moves out, we know that we're going to have white neighbors again.
Mm-hmm.
They made that illegal in 1948 in Shelley versus Kramer with basically a legal fiction that has never been extended to anything or used again and highly criticized, but never overturned. Kind of a 14th Amendment theory that really doesn't exist outside of anywhere but Shelley versus Kramer. What happened is there's a group of people that wanted to get rid of racial restrictive covenants, and they were going to. And they were – a lot of people have this I guess – I don't know what the proper word is, but sort of this almost mythical view of constitutional law of – like it's always right and it's always done by the book. It's really the people on the Supreme Court and people arguing these cases are very often political actors that are very motivated by political or racial reasons. And they already have an idea in mind. So when they wanted to do outlaw racially restrictive covenants, or when they wanted to integrate schools in Brown versus Board, they didn't think this is the right way to do this constitutionally, and this is how the law should be. They thought, I wanted to outlaw this and to outlaw segregation, and I'm going to do it, and I'll figure out the theory later.
Oh, that's a good example of that is Brown versus Board of Education. Yeah,
that's probably the best example of it. That and Shelley versus Kramer, the two.
The Warren Court in general. Yeah,
the Warren Court. Before that, they even kind of weighed some of the history of Brown is interesting. That they basically had to wait for some Supreme Court justices to die to get, you know, you had to have Eisenhower appoint Warren and get the Warren Court, and then they had to make some, you know, the whole thing was crazy the way Thurgood Marshall
that doll test or something.
there was foreign forum shopping going on, really. A lot of those places went to the federal courts because you had lefty presidents, including Eisenhower, for years appointing people on the federal circuits, and they knew if they took these to state courts that they would never, a state judge would never do it, because these are local people who understand the community and answer to local people. And they had these federal judges appointed for life by these people, you know, like Wilson and FDR and Eisenhower, that were just going crazy. But yeah, one of the big myths is that these are like actual people who are upholding the Constitution. They're not. They're political actors doing political things. And yeah, it's just really interesting.
All that I guess you had the Berman v. Parker, which allowed for urban renewal. At the same time, I think it was the Roth decision regarding pornography, where there was community standards, but if pornography had redeeming quality, then it was covered by the First Amendment. You know, before that, you just had simple obscenity laws.
Before you have there's a good book called Merchants of Sin that gets into a lot of those, the way that basically pornographers kind of got pornography into First Amendment jurisprudence where it hadn't previously been, because before, you know, if something was obscene, it didn't really qualify as protected speech and you could outlaw it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they essentially, did away with that, with, like you said, the Roth case and a couple others. So,
and they started using the U.S. Mail Service to like distribute, you know, pornography like Playboy.
Yeah,
yeah. And it's kind of funny because they said, "Well, it only goes to adults." So, really, once you distribute it, how do you control its proliferation?
Yeah.
And now we have a society today where every kid with a smartphone can, you know.
Yeah,
and they say, "Well, it's up to you to control it," and the parent.
And they could probably pass something that's like an opt-in. A lot of countries, I think Israel has one, where the pornography is basically blocked by the ISP. So, you know, you sign up for the internet and it's blocked, and then you have to call them. And you can just call them and say, hey, this is so-and-so. They verify your account, say, I'd like to get pornography. And then, okay, you can get to it now.
So Israel has more restrictive laws regarding pornography and immigration.
They definitely do, yeah.
But they advocate, but Jews in American United States advocate, you know, open borders.
Oh, also, gambling is very heavily restricted, and most of the online gambling operations are out of Israel. But in Israel, gambling is very restricted. So that's another interesting thing that you see. The pornography, the immigration, the gambling, it's all, they have it restricted for their people while they push it everywhere else. But you could probably, I'm sure, you know, that the pornography lobby group is big, but you could pass. I mean, I don't think having an opt out or opt in provision, you know, I guess it just depends on how it's challenged and what kind of scrutiny you would receive. But that's a very clear commerce thing. So it wouldn't be anywhere near the limits of what the Congress has used the Commerce Clause for. If they were to say, we're going to use our commerce power authority to make ISPs do an opt-in provision for pornography, it would be well within, you know, other things that they've done. But, you know, they don't do it. They'll probably never do it. I mean, these current people will never do it. Something kind of to think about in the future that, okay, we'll use the Commerce Clause and we'll get at it this way. You know what I mean? Just something for future people to think about if they even want to use the current Constitution.
But I do find interesting that the internet in general, but the various host sites, will YouTube, whatever, they'll allow pornography, but they'll restrict political speech, which is the complete opposite of what in the intent of the First Amendment.
Totally backwards. And you'll even have, it's just absolute common world. I mean, there's nothing really else to say that other than what you said. It's kind of the opposite of the intent. You're supposed to be able to, you know, whether it was on a theory of you're in a town square or in the Micklejohn's town hall theory, or whether it was just your personal autonomy theory that which kind of arises sort of out of natural law, I guess, that I should be able to say stuff and you shouldn't be able to stop me. Whatever the theory is, none of that matters. It's just nobody mentions anything about it. You get silenced off the internet for political views.
And you can, again, Congress could pass a law because this is all commerce. I mean, if interstate commerce can require, a bed and breakfast, a hotel, a restaurant to not discriminate on race, then Congress could devise a law that says any company that's involved in interstate commerce cannot deplatform or cut off services, like financial services, for someone who hasn't committed any crime, just has voiced political speech or point of view. They could say, you can't do this, but they don't want to do that, because that type of legislation would be meaningful in promoting actual free speech and public discourse on all these matters that we're discussing.
Yeah, and it would be that simple, is what you just said. It's a law under the Commerce Clause.
But you know, like, how liberals, they're just ardent free market advocates, right?
Now they are. Yeah. It's funny. They're growing towards a more, they like the neoliberal model, you know, which is this fusion. So they're going to keep defending these companies because they're woke and stuff. But yeah, it would be that simple. A legislation that says we're using our Commerce Clause powers to protect lawful speech on the internet. And they could have pages and pages of justification of using kind of these First Amendment theories, Commerce Clause theories. And, you know, I've made that same argument to people. I said, hey, if you can force a little mom-pa coffee shop to serve everybody, why can't, you know, we make Twitter, who has a monopoly on microblogging, to let me stay on and, you know.
Especially Silicon Valley, because whether it's Google, Twitter, the tech giants, they've all been, you know, deluged with taxpayer dollars from the get-go.
Absolutely. And, you know, people I've had lefties say, like, well, race is a protected class. Political ideology is it. I'm like, okay, but that's just still a function of legal mumbo jumbo. Ultimately, I mean, I understand what you're saying. It's a 14th Amendment thing, but
it's, but speeches, like, that's the Constitution. That's the first
Amendment. That is too. That's what I was saying too. they're applying the 14th Amendment to private people, essentially. So why can't they apply the First Amendment to private people?
Yeah.
So these people who make this argument about, well, this isn't a protected class, they're doing it in bad faith because they're saying on one hand, you know, it's a protected class, not a protected class, while ignoring the fact that, like, that's just a Congress enacted thing, just like anything else. You
know? That was there to enforce, you know, anti-discrimination laws that were passed in the 60s because they couldn't prove discrimination. So when you're a protected class, I think it's presumed when you bring a case that that I think pretty much puts the defendant in the awkward position to actually prove that he's innocent or something.
It gets strict scrutiny if it's a protected class. It's the hardest. So if the government makes some law and it's, you know, presumed protected class and you get, or like a fundamental right, you get strict scrutiny. So now the government has to prove that this was like a compelling government interest, and this was the least restrictive way to do it. And they almost always fail strict scrutiny. It's very hard to pass it.
It's just like how quotas came about, you know, with the Equal Employment Opportunity laws and Equal Opportunity Commission itself. Well, you couldn't prove discrimination, but you could look at a disparity, a statistical disparity, and that was prima facie evidence of discrimination, despite the fact that groups aren't equal, and especially if you're dealing with specific industries or trades. Yeah,
that's the thing. Yeah, they use disparate impact with the faulty assumption that everybody's starting the same, and that's not the case.
Yeah.
And some of this jurisprudence stuff is just like, you know, if you, like me, I started law school. I had pretty much, I was just editing the book after I started law school. I already published it, Occidental Observer and Countercurrents and stuff. So, you know, I'm sitting there in some of this and they're talking about, okay, you know, you need strict scrutiny to pass this if it's based on race. And then we get to these affirmative action cases on college admissions, and then it's basically like, except white people, and I'm just sitting there like, you dirty rats, like, you know, it's just so, and then most of the people are just sitting there and just like accepting it for what it is on its face, and it's amazing.
It's outcomes based jurisprudence.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. They're just looking at outcomes, and they'll say, well, you know, diversity is a compelling interest. So, you know, why? They just say,
well, what about, you know, the diversity of having like poor Appalachian whites in Harvard?
Yeah, that would be compelling, I would think, but they don't see it that way, obviously. But they'll just say these things, like, you know, to go back to Brown about, you know, they say, well, black people are psychologically damaged by not getting to go to school with whites. Why? You know?
Well, actually, it's a backhanded insult, really.
Yeah, that's what they say. And, you know, they just provide these conclusory statements and with no backup. And same thing with these affirmative action. Well, diversity is a compelling interest. Well, okay, but why? Like, where's like, I have a zillion studies that show diversity leads to, you know, not good outcomes.
Well, in the article you had about friendship, you had this picture of a high school yearbook.
Yeah, yeah.
And the aesthetics are disturbing.
Yeah, that's another thing. Yeah. There's all kind. That's funny you bring that up. I joke about with a buddy of mine in law school that. So you can pass laws. States can pass laws that are just for aesthetic things. They can say we want, you know, maybe a city or something wants a particular type of architecture in their city, and they can enforce it. And it's a purely aesthetic, you know, it's a purely aesthetic law. That's it. Has nothing to do with anything other than we think this looks better. And I always joke with him with, like, we could use just an aesthetic argument for migration if we wanted. And, we could really go places with that aesthetic argument.
Well, if people are being honest, they, you know, even white liberals are upset by it, which is why they escape those areas if they can afford it. And they live in areas that are essentially segregated anyway, just by economics. The idea, even if you think it's a good idea to mix things up in schools and the problem is you're forcing children to navigate that, to deal with it every day. That's unfair because kids shouldn't have to go to a Tower of Babel and deal with all the problems and never that come that, you know, that the problems that they think are good experiences, really just everyday hurdles and problems, bullying, violence, you know, not be able to make friends and these things, lack of, you know, I guess, local patriotism or to a community, these things in the school really becomes, you can't identify with that school. And again, you create a situation where you graduate, never have any long-term friends or anything because you don't relate to anybody. You're atomized, you know, and especially if you're white, you're demonized, you know, so.
Yeah. So not only are you, you know, you're thrown in this polyglot tower babble cluster, you're sitting there as like, 10% white kid, 10% of the class white kids, listening to how you're evil for white privilege and how you raped and enslaved and did all these horrible things to these other kids, and they're just, glaring at you.
And the irony, of course, is that minorities can go to white schools and not suffer violence. The reverse isn't true. That's just a reality.
Yeah.
Now, theoretically, it could be true, but in reality, it's not true because of other conditions that obtain. That's the problem is not, and it's covered up, not talked about. And you talked, earlier we talked about crime. It just simply isn't talked about, the racial angle to these crimes.
Yeah, that's the stuff that they're taught. And some of the stuff I look back and kind of think I was exposed to. I actually got funny stories. A lot of people ask me about how I got red pilled or something like that. Because a lot of people, especially online,
article you had the story about that young girl with the mother, it was disturbing.
That wasn't, I guess, necessarily a red pill. That's the why I write article about a girl that was gang raped in my hometown. That was kind of why I got involved. Why I decided to kind of be, use my real face and everything and name and start publishing stuff. It was kind of one of these things that was always sort of just how I was raised. I remember in sixth grade, we were doing a Holocaust unit and reading Eli Wiesel's Night. And I got sent to the principal's office in sixth grade. I'm 11 or 12 years old for laughing in the middle of it. There was some scene, I don't know what it was, but I thought it was the funniest thing to me. And I got in trouble and had to go to the principal's office and got in detention for laughing during Eli Wiesel's Night, a reading of it.
Is this the one where he claims that certain colors are flames? You could tell by which...
I'm not sure if that one...
Whether it was a Polish Jew or a Hungarian Jew.
You would know what color by the color of the smoke, what ethnicity they were or something. I'm not sure if that was in that because I didn't end up reading the whole thing. But I had to get sent home with a note to my parents about why I laughed so hard during the Holocaust part. and my dad... Dad's German. They didn't care at all.
Jets.
So nothing. He was kind of good for you, son. But it's they push this stuff, and it's all this Common Core stuff pushed by a guy named David Coleman, who's a Jewish guy. He's kind of the architect of Common Core, and they work with. The reason I kind of brought that story up is they, we talk about you being demonized and. He's on record, some of the Common Core people, there's a video out there saying that part of Common Core is to end white privilege and to dismantle whiteness. And, I saw Amistad and Roots and they had Read Diary of a Young Girl and all this stuff. And I look into it later, who the hell, who's making me learn all this stuff? And I look it up and I'm like, oh, of course. And, white people were enslaved by Arabs and Jews, by the millions for years, and they never teach you that in school.
Well, the Irish, there's a was it Canal Street in New Orleans or something where it's called Canal Street because they tried to build a canal there, and they wanted to use African slaves, but the African slaves are worth too much, so they used Irish,
some of it just doesn't really pass just a basic kind of inspection on a lot of these stories about the horrors of World War II or slavery.
A lot of it's been now. It's like porn. They got to exaggerate it, and that's what's they've exaggerated, like Django Unchained type thing.
It's so fantastic, and it keeps getting, because people are sensitized to it, they keep getting more and more outrageous every year with it.
Yeah, there was a thing in the 1930s. Part of one of the New Deal programs was hiring writers to go down south and get testimonies from surviving slaves. Some were still around in the 1930s. They were elderly at this point, and the idea was to get them called the slave narratives. The first-hand account of slavery. And they were shocked because overwhelmingly the old people looked at back in the days, the pre-war days, as actually they were nostalgic.
And
it isn't what they wanted. I mean, so they didn't publish it. And if you take, if you really think about it, I can see that they're younger. Everyone's nostalgic about their youth, but it wasn't the everyday whipping that, you know, we got with Roots and with Django Unchained. It's just, you know, and the fact of the matter is that in many ways, life in the South was better than the North, even for slaves compared to like factory workers in the North. The life expectancy was longer. They were generally healthier. But again, the narrative, because it has to fit the moral fairy tale and narrative being given. So it has to be characterized as the horrible, most brutal thing ever, you know, and gets lost in there's actually any idea, any really understanding of what life was like in the South, you know, before the Civil War. But it's funny. They were nostalgic about it. You know, they're, you know.
Yeah, that is, I mean, it just, man, some of it, I often think about some of that, about how awful thing that, you know, they claim things were. And it's just, you know, I still hear every week or so, I mentioned about other things here, every week, I still hear someone bring up Emmett Till like every week. And, you know, every week since Emmett Till was killed, there's been like a white person killed in a similar or more horrific way. And you don't hear about them. And it just, you know, it just gets tiresome after a while.
Well, what's going on in Europe now, you know, with rape, incidents of rape have exploded, and 80-90% of them are occurred, you know, by migrants, you know, from Africa or the Middle East. And a lot of the stuff is easily foreseen. I mean, this is sort of using these people's proxies, as shock troops, as to come in and make life unbearable to create some sort of, you know, alchemy or some sort of result. And this is this was actually demonstrated in the 1960s in the United States, where Office of Economic Opportunity, which is then led by Sergeant Shriver, gave close to $1 million to a black gang in Chicago called the Blackstone Rangers. And their job was to go in and just make life, I think, unbearable. I think this was a Polish neighborhood.
Wow.
But it was...
Yeah, I didn't know that story, but I mean, there's just... It's crazy. The amount of similar...
But their own government, the idea of the federal government come in and actually... This isn't shocking to me anymore, but for most Americans, it would be very disorienting to find out that their own government was actually in there promoting criminal behavior to promote white flight, to disperse the neighborhood. And this type of psychological warfare and demographic warfare we're seeing played out all over the world now.
Yeah, I mean, you see the one thing I guess something similar I've known about for a while that I post from time to time is when the 104th First Airborne and the Army was marching white school kids into the high school at Bayonet Point, you know, when they were forcing integration on them in Little Rock and some other places in Arkansas. So, you know, these are people, it's not that they weren't even these white high school kids that were protesting segregation. It's not that they were like attacking the blacks or saying, or trying to keep the blacks out. They were basically saying, okay, there's blacks in there. We are protesting and don't want to go in. And then they turned their rifles on them and marched them right in. And it's just, you know, there's pictures of it, all kinds of pictures of that. And it's just...
Was it Charlotte Mecklenburg where the Charmec decision, as they call it, where the city then did away with their public schools in reaction to forced integration? And then they made them open the schools?
I'm not sure where that was, but that happened.
Yeah.
That definitely happened. They closed them down. There was places... There was a suit. I think it's called Allen versus Wright, which was... So after the forced segregation in the South, a lot of these like private charter schools popped up that were for basically whites only. And there was a suit where it was Allen versus Wright, where these black people were saying they were trying to get it's kind of a complicated case, but they're trying to get the IRS to not let the white parents write off the private school education because they were only going to the private school to get away from blacks. And they were saying, you've basically created de facto segregation because our public schools are now only black because all the white kids fled. So what was really going on is the schools were getting so bad and the kids couldn't get an education and they were getting harassed so much by blacks all the parents, even ones without money, pulled him out, did whatever they had to do, work another job if the dad had to, send him to private school. They were able to deduct that on their taxes, get a little bit of savings. And then the blacks were so mad and vindictive about it. There's obviously other people involved that are helping fund, you know, as with the whole civil rights movement. But they were so pissed off and vindictive that they found this kind of way around their scheme that they tried to get the IRS to not let them write off the education expense and kind of force them back into these ghetto schools.
Yeah. And
so that old maxim of diversity is chasing down the last white person, it really is that way. They don't want you to get away. There was a case in there's been all these cases of like people trying to break away. They're trying to like get themselves annexed or break away from the larger school district and doing these weird kind of what sort of looks like gerrymandering. They're by trying to keep their school district white. There was a case. Let me find it for you real quick. It was just a shocking headline, but basically what the headline was is that because citing racial diversity, the school wasn't letting these white kids transfer schools. Like if they moved out, they would just bus them right back to this shitty ghetto school.
So they're more or less they're enslaved.
And they would say things like cite, you know, well, we need to keep the racial balance for test scores. What they mean is if all the white kids leave, the test scores will just tank. But it's just you're starting to see this pop up. And I think there's going to be if there's any, you know, buddy out there that's a lawyer, going to be a lawyer, thinking about being a lawyer, you're seeing it, you know, more and more and more of these school, these like little municipalities trying to break away from their school board and form their own school board. And I think this is going to be a thing in the future. Because as it's going to come up more and more as these schools are more diverse. And like in the story I wrote about the girl, kind of far out in the country, basically these black kids who got kicked out of the larger urban school get like the second chance program out in the country, and they ended up gang raping a white girl. And as that continues to happen, people are going to try to break away and find ways to get out of the school district. And it's, you know, if they just go the private route, it's unfortunate because they have to pay for the private school and property taxes. So they're getting, that's kind of, I think, why they're trying to do this. People who are not rich are trying to get around it. And it's really unfair to them that these middle class or low middle class people are trying to, you know, deal with this stuff just their kids to get a normal education.
Yeah. And then not get killed or raped.
Yeah, exactly. It's not even just about getting education; it's physical safety.
Yeah, and how bad do you have to be to get kicked out of an urban public school?
Yeah, these schools were really terrible where they got kicked out of, and where they went to was it used to be a real nice white community, and now, like one of the markets where I shop, there's security. Now they have security guards and cameras, and you know, my whole time living out here, I didn't have to prepay the pump or like, you know, have security cameras everywhere. Now I do.
Yeah, you talk about in your piece about the 7-Eleven America in the 80s. Yeah. Obviously, it's the 80s. Yeah. You know, that's when my coming of age in the 80s. And just how much society has changed since then. And not as if the 80s were golden period. We were well along the way by the 80s. But
sure.
Yeah.
It was still like a culture. It still felt more culturally white from, you know, my little experience in it growing up in the 90s. It, you know, the music wasn't as degenerate. The movies were still pretty wholesome. It's still... it seems really accelerated, I guess.
I mean, you talk about this whole idea of minority rights and these things. I think minorities certainly can be tolerated and have their rights respected.
Sure.
But they have to, the reality is, and this is the reality is they have to stay the minority. What I mean by that is just a demographic issue. And this is admitted. This is why the Southern Poverty Law Center is charting the decline of white America. And this is why you have articles talking about how the browning of America portends, you know, cultural and political changes for the country. And you write about this in the book, how certain things like the Constitution, aspects of the Bill of Rights, even the entire Bill of Rights, aren't going to be respected at all when the country becomes, you know, majority, minority in quotations, because the culture won't be there anymore. And
no, that's just an old document written by some white people that had slaves to
them. Especially when they're being taught that. People are being taught that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're being taught that explicitly.
Yeah.
That these are, this was a document written by white privileged men who raped slaves and beat them and hated black people. So what are they going to care about it, you know? But that article is from NBC4i.com. It's Ohio District says it'll stop allowing white students to leave district citing racial balance. It's from April of 2018. So this isn't like, you know, right after Brown 2 came down. This is last year.
Well, this goes to the whole idea of racial balance, as if their social engineers, our betters, are telling us. I mean, this goes, I mean, I think it was Meyerdahl who said in his, when he's writing, when he's giving it, speaking on behalf of the American Dilemma, the book that he supposedly wrote, is probably ghostwritten for him. He's the one that said that you'd have to have sort of a critarchy step in and imposed by judicial activism, these things, because America was irredeemably racist. This Swede who knew so much about America. But he said that frankly speaking, that people aren't going to be allowed to live where they want to live anymore. And this is the mentality where you can, there's someone, social engineer, what have you, a sociologist or some looking at the numbers, and they're deciding what the proper balance is. Well, what is the proper balance? I mean, I would say, if anything, understanding is that people are happier in living next to people who are like them, whether it's ethnic or religious, whatever. And this is how people should be allowed to live, especially if you're supposed to be living in a free country. But they're the ones playing games with the numbers, moving people around like concrete, you know, treating them like animals, like they can be engineered. You know.
Yeah, it's just getting, it's sad and it's kind of getting worse. I'm hoping we can.
Well, I mean, if you look at a state like Vermont or something, Maine, they'll say it's too white. Yeah. Well, I don't know, is Louisiana too black? I mean, it's like,
is any of these states, is Zimbabwe too black? Well, actually, Zimbabwe is a bad example because, yes, it is. It's not Rhodesia, but is Botswana too black?
Or, what's that? The place in South Africa, Arana or something?
Arania, yeah.
It's 2000. But there's an example where this small white community, where there's enough social and human capital, they start to develop some relative prosperity. Then it wants to be, the outsiders want to come and smash it.
Yeah, and you see that constantly, man. I commented not too long ago at lunch that I was very dissatisfied being at the mall and being surrounded by Somalis. And this person who lives in one of the most affluent white parts of the city was like, you know, feigned offense. Like, how could you say that? I'm like, listen, Somalis don't even want to live with Somalis. That's why they moved out in the middle of nowhere, to be away from Somalis. Like,
how'd they get there? Did they walk?
Yeah, exactly. They probably got on the ADL Express and showed up here.
There are NGOs, and this is all traceable, where all this is paid for, whether it's from south of the border. There's I think it was John Q. Publius.
Yeah, there's tons of them. There's Hebrew Immigration Aid Society. There's a bunch of Christian ones, bunch of Jewish ones. Yeah,
and the Jewish ones are running like Catholic charities.
They do. That's interesting. If you look at some of those where people say, well, it's Christians doing it too, and you kind of like keep tracing it a little bit more, you're like, damn it every time. But yeah, they have all these NGOs that have tons of money. Some of them get, like Hebrew Immigration Aid Society, I believe, gets millions of dollars from the U.S. government, so it's taxpayer money.
Yep.
So kind of in this weird roundabout way, getting, you know, you just pay for your own replacements, you pay for their welfare. A lot of these people, like I document in the book, from different places. There's like 10 countries in the Middle East where we have a bunch coming, where 90% of them are more on welfare. From Mexico and Central America, it's like 70% or more on welfare. Just tremendous numbers. But yeah, you know, even to normie people, I say, I don't really like all these Somalis here. And they're like, well, why do you say that? I'm like, well, if they wanted to live in Somalia, I don't want to live in Somalia. They don't want to live in Somalia. Like, why should I, you know, what the hell?
Well,
it just should be obvious.
And why are U.S. government or NGOs facilitating this without asking the people who live there? Who are they?
They don't ask. Yeah. You get no choice. You know, these people, they get the choice to live in the U.S. or Germany or Somalia. And I basically, if I want to be around my own people, I don't have a choice anymore.
Did you see that videotape? This is about a year ago of, I think it was the Chipotle in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Where there's a Dash Dine and Dash thing, where basically they're Somali, maybe second generation. Now they're teenagers.
Yeah.
And this group will go around the various restaurants, order the meal, eat it, and run.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but doesn't surprise me at all.
So they have it on, they had their smartphones running, so they had their camera running, and they were complaining because the white guy in front of them didn't have to pay first. And the lady, the manager, who I think was Hispanic, saying, no, you have to pay first. And says, okay. How come he doesn't have to pay? He says, well, because he actually pays and you don't. She was wise to them. And then she says, well, that's racist. They pretty much, you hear this, they're maybe a generation, but their parents came from the east coast of Africa. And now already they've embraced the language of victimization of America.
Yeah,
and
they learned it quick.
Well, it turns out that she refused to serve them and it became a scandal and they fired her. Okay, and then it turns out that these idiots posted online bragging about this incident and also how they ripped off other restaurants.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
so it turns out that here they have this business model which is based on high trust being ruined.
Yeah,
and this is why you have like food deserts in high crime areas because you can't operate a business there if it requires high trust. And this is an example of it. And you didn't have this problem in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And you do have a problem, all of America being ruined by them. Obviously that horrible story last winter, the kid being thrown
Landon Hoffman in Mall of America, thrown like five stories. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. There was first of all, you walk around these malls, it's like you're in a Somali bazaar. There was a recent one, some Hispanic guy drove his SUV through a mall. There's been several of these, like they call them flash mobs, but they're like these kind of these looting riot things.
Yeah.
Like 10 of these urban youth will go in and just carry out handfuls of stuff from the store. You're dealing with that. I haven't verified this. I mean, I'm sure it's around this. I just don't know what the exact number is. But somebody said they heard a fact. So this is like, third hand. But that some retail or loss prevention company, one of those inventory companies, calculated that about 400 Americans that actually buy stuff spend $400 or so extra on what is essentially a shoplifting tax.
Yeah.
So companies have to, obviously they get so much loss, they have to raise prices to account for the loss so they hit their profit and all that. And, we pay another $400. It's one of these like dark figures of diversity. And, I saw one article that said about the insane amount of hit and runs by illegal aliens without licenses. And mm-hmm. So all that property damage and all those insurance premiums going up, that's another. So when you see these figures about how much diversity and immigration cost, the shoplifting tax isn't in there. The insurance premiums aren't in there. The property theft isn't in there. There's all sorts of stuff that's just not in there. It's just an untold amount, all in all.
Yeah, I was talking to someone who worked at a public school, and there's a large Hispanic community in the area. And virtually, 75% of the students are Hispanic in the public schools, and virtually every child – it gets paid lunch.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's all that, they're not paying, this is a sop to the whatever company supplies the food because the other one's getting rich off it. You can't tell me that those children's parents couldn't marshal enough resources to bag a lunch for them every day. This assumption that everyone is impoverished or helpless and just encouraged the dependency. Just assumed. This is just assumed.
And you always see these like child care and Medicare scams with these people mm-hmm. that is into the hundreds of millions a year. Every year or so I see it's the same thing. They do the child care where they start like a fake child care and they all have like 9 kids and they all say they're watching X amount of kids and they get so much money a kid and they do the same thing with like Medicare, some sort of Medicare fraud. Those aren't figured into the cost. I have a buddy that was working at the at municipal court, and he said, this isn't an incredibly diverse state or city where I'm in. There's places that have way, way, way higher rates. I'm in the interior of the U.S. It's not like I'm on a border state or anything. And he said every single day there was tons of illegals, and they had – it was like a a quarter or more of the cases he had one day, he said that they had to pay for an interpreter, which aren't cheap. So the taxpayers are paying for interpreters for these people who can't speak English, are here committing crimes. They go to municipal court. Not only do we have to pay for their public defendant, pay for the court time, we have to hire more prosecutors because of all of them, have to hire interpreters for them. You know, I mean, this one person who maybe, let's just assume, best case scenario, they have a job and pay taxes. They're not even near going to break even on that.
No,
just,
yeah.
For just their one criminal case, not let alone the $10,000 it costs for their kid to go to public school, you know, and they have five of the kids. So even the ones that pay taxes, there's such a net negative that it's not even close to being a good deal, whether it's, you know, a small bump in GDP. I did a thing in the book. I talked about it somewhere where aggregate GDP versus GDP per capita, and how these are very even the argument from GDP that we need migrants to grow GDP, they're very inefficient market cogs.
Mm-hmm.
So the more of them that we have, the GDP per capita actually drops. So you just, you know, you just see all kinds of, well, it's just crazy.
If you had domestic policies that actually fostered, you know, encouraged higher birth rates among the native population, you wouldn't need to import the cheaper labor.
Yeah, and there's tons of countries that have done them. There's countries doing them right now, like in Italy and Poland. They're doing like a, you know, you get more money back for a kid, and you get some, I think Italy had like a land thing, and there's been historic regimes that if you were stayed married and each additional kid you had, you know, you got part of your mortgage loan if it was government forgiven. And basically, if you stayed together and had four kids, you could live like just to, you know, have a, get a house, a little starter house for free kind of deal.
But here's the trap is, and this is where kind of like where Sweden's in this trap, where the result of these policies has resulted in sort of a demoralized, atomized society. Smaller families, no families. I think more than half of Swedish adults live alone. And then all of a sudden you have the population problem. But in order to address the population problem, you have to revert to traditional ways of life. And it means traditional sexual morality, traditional family roles, encouraging patriarchy, and moving away from feminism, which are all tricks for enslavement. But this, no one wants the ruling elite, the oligarchy, the government, these things, the academia, entertainment, they don't want to give up the ghost, give up that idea, this ideological commitment. Because one thing may simply believe it, they've been tricked into believing it, and that's. But ultimately, I think it's a trick to enslave everybody, to create a.
Yeah, the people that are at the upper echelons of this, they know what they're doing. They're evil people that know what they're doing. The people, kind of the middlings, that one of the things I talked about too, I guess to kind of maybe sweep back and round out the whole thing. You know, the idea that like these people have these liberals have these thought processes that lead to these very unfavorable results that we've been talking about. The kind of upper elite group of people, I think they still have some. They still are not right. They're more like sociopaths though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're lying. They're manipulative. They're very very evil people. And they stick to these lies, and they lead to bad outcomes for us. It might be good outcomes for them, but, you know, in kind of getting back to this, like, classical psychology of it, a lot of sociopaths and psychopaths, even though these outcomes are horrible for society as a whole and for the individuals they interact with, often for them, personally, it was a good, rational choice and got them what they wanted, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but that doesn't mean we still don't have a name for them that's a sociopath or psychopath. So that's kind of one thread. And the other thread is, like, people talked about one of the, I guess, criticisms or things that I just like to address, maybe it's even my own criticisms of myself, is that one of the things I talk about in the book a lot is this cognitive rigidity. So if somebody's, and I recently wrote an article about Greta Thunberg and, like, environmentalism and some of these single-issue liberals. So there's people I've known that were liberals because they hated the GOP and neocons. And I hate the GOP and neocons too, so, you know, understandably. And they have these ideas on race or environmentalism. And I've talked to them, and I've said, you know, If you're worried about the safety of women and children, you should look at who's doing the raping. If you're worried about the environment, you should look at who's doing the poaching and dumping all the trash in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And they kind of come around because the mainstream media, you know, people like yourself and me, we're trying to get, you know, these messages out there and get more people to hear us with sympathy and all that. But they stifle us and they make it hard for us. So there's a whole bunch of people who have some of these liberal sympathies, but I wouldn't say that they are mentally ill or in this kind of my actual characterization of this liberalism, because they, once they're exposed to the proper data, they sort of snap out of it and move to something else. And I think that's an important thing, the cognitive rigidity and kind of how invested they are in their liberalism. So if somebody's, you know, kind of a liberal because, you know, they came of age during the Bush years and they hate Bush and they think the Iraq war was stupid. Okay. But then maybe you show them who was very instrumental in pushing the Iraq war. And next thing you know, they're like way on our side, you know? Mm-hmm. And so those people I don't really consider to be the like ardent liberals, the kind that have that I would qualify as any sort of mental illness. I would say this is just a kind of a person that hasn't, maybe they're immature, maybe they haven't been exposed to the facts. Maybe it's a very passing thing for them. Politics isn't really their thing, you know? And like I said, yeah, then the other, so that kind of covers the whole rank and file, whether they're really true believers or whether they're just sort of passing through political ideologies. And then, you know, the other group, you know, these kind of these rootless cosmopolitans at the top of it, they're just they've been doing this like we've talked about for, you know, you and I have just covered decades and decades of it. And you can go back even before they were doing it. And they just kind of the menace of our civilization. And that's sort of where I see it all, I guess, and come back full circle.
Yeah, it's the exploitation of cheap labor, importing it, and to disrupt the host society.
Tunneled in like rats, and we gotta the people that can be reached. I think there's a swath of liberals that consider themselves liberals that can be reached. You know, if they're anti-war, and you say, hey, let me show you something about who was really involved in these wars.
Yeah,
or maybe they're, you know, whatever it is, you might be able to reach them. And then there's a group of people who are so committed to this, like, egalitarianism. A lot of those people are kind of, I think, sort of, they are like these misfits a lot of times. You know, different people have written about communism and the type of people that like this ideology. These kind of like weak, effeminate men and these amorphous-looking people. And just, you know, these fringes kind of people that we talk about. And then there's sort of the final boss tier, and yeah, sort of what we're up against.
Well, to follow your work, what's the best place?
Hey Wild Rich on Twitter, and if you go to countercurrents.com, you can search Houck, Houck, and you'll find a bunch of stuff up there.
Okay, and where's the best place to get your book?
You can get it on the Amazon website or directly at ArcToast at arctoast.com.
Excellent. Listen, well, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was really nice chatting. I appreciate it.
I'll let you go and enjoy the remains of your weekend. I post this soon. I'll send you the link.
Yeah, send me the link. I'll post it up.
And of course, in the near future, perhaps have you back on sometime. Talk about something more specific, perhaps, or whatever comes up. You know. So
yeah, that would be good. I have a couple things coming soon about architecture and city planning. If you're into any of that kind of stuff,
Okay, great. I'll let you
get
go.
Into that.
Thank you so much. Just have a happy Thanksgiving and holidays and all that. So.
Thank you. You too. Hopefully, I'll talk to you soon.
Good night. Bye bye.
Thanks. Bye.